Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Simon Phipps joins me. We're going to be talking about YottaDB, a huge, fast, powerful database. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Simon Phipps, episode 510, recorded December 12, 2018, YottaDB. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, a podcast from Red Hat. Listen to the epic true tales of the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels revolutionizing the technology landscape. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit redhat.com/heroes today. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with. I think today is going to be one of those. Joining me today is someone who hasn't been around for a little while, but he's back again. Simon Phipps, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Randall. I have actually been around a great deal, just not here. I've been all over the place for the last 3 months. We're coming to the end of the Open Source Initiative's 20th birthday year, and I've been doing keynotes in I don't know how many places, 20 or at least 20 places since I last saw you.
Well, your travel schedule might be how bad it was. So it's kind of a really mess there. So, but I'm glad you could join us today, and you're still back in Southampton, I presume?
I am. It's a chilly, clear evening here in Southampton, and I'm back in Mink headquarters, trying to file all my expenses before the end of the year.
Awesome, cool. And I am in, as I've been saying for the last 7 weeks, I am at KubeCon, or as I like to call it, KubeCon. So I can say, on this last time I could say this, in Xanadu did KubeCon, a stately pleasure dome decree. So I've been having a great time here. I've been bumping into a few of y'all have come up to me and said, hi, thanks for the show. And I watch it every week. And I go, cool. So I do actually have audience members. This is definitely confirmed now since people in the flesh have come up to me and said hi. And I'm on Wi-Fi, so there might be the occasional freeze in the video. And hopefully we'll cover the audio cleanly. So those of you that are listening on audio will have a nice, clean experience. But those of you watching the video might occasionally see me freeze from time to time. But don't get scared. I will thaw. Yes, this is not the movie Frozen, so that'll be good. So today we have an interesting project on. We always have interesting projects on. What am I saying? It's all great. Today we're going to be talking about YottaDB. YottaDB is a let's get the little talk here. It's a new kind of database delivering a proven database engine to your application, enhancing simplicity, security, stability, and scalability. Now, this show was actually suggested by the guys we had on a couple weeks ago that were talking about Vista, because this is a database that's written to be high performance and written in MUMPS. So they're going to talk to us about how that all came about and why MUMPS and what else can it talk to, things like that. We have two guests today. We have Bhaskar and Chris Edwards. They'll be joining us in a couple of moments, but just want to cover up a little, cover up. I want to reveal the opposite of cover up. Just how this is. So this is a NoSQL database, but it has ACID compliance, and I got to ask about how that all works. So it's similar to say. A transaction-based database like transactions in MySQL and Postgres and Oracle, where you can say begin a transaction, do a bunch of things like move money from one account to the other, and then commit, and you're guaranteed that the money doesn't get dropped in the middle somewhere, or so the accounts get out of balance. So this is it's going to be fun to play with. Simon's going to be covering all the wonderful things about community and licensing and distribution and future roadmap, all that sort of stuff. I'm going to be trying to pick up the technical heavyweight stuff because that's how we're going to do that. Simon, before we get started, do you want to see anything here?
I loved your comment there that this is a new kind of database, because I'm just reading a page here that about MUMPS. And a key feature of MUMPS was that it included a hand-in-glove connection with a schemaless, hierarchical, sparse, associative memory key-value database, the original NoSQL database, although the term had not been invented then in the late 60s. Wow. You know, the programming environment that this is created in was the place that NoSQL came from. So that any sense of novelty here is kind of diminished by that connection with history.
True, true. And also, as I recall, a PIC is something similar to that, where you had a built into the language, which is really an operating system, the PIC operating system, there was an inherent key value store. And so I don't know whether PIC precedes MUMPS or whether it's after, but it's pretty old. I was on a project once.
Yeah, there was a lot of it about back in the day. Because, you know, I used to work at Unisys, and they had a thing called Link there, which basically was another one of these, you know, programming environment come database come spreadsheet table come email system. Like all of these, they all evolved into a place where the programming environment had become a complete suite of software. Presumably that's why it had to be discontinued, because you couldn't innovate anymore. You had to reinvent it all again.
Well, we'll have plenty to talk about with our guests in a moment. But before we do that, we do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Command Line Heroes, an original podcast for geeks, by geeks, from Red Hat, a company that's been bringing open source technologies to the enterprise for years.
Command Line Heroes are the developers, programmers, hackers, geeks, and open source rebels who are revolutionizing the technology landscape.
The Command Line Heroes podcast is hosted by Saran Yatbarak, a developer who founded Code Newbie and lives and breathes open source software. Season 2 is all about living on the command line and tracking the changes that shape the world of open source development, from programming languages to learning about supercomputers, hybrid clouds, and more. On the latest episode, they explore what serverless really means and what developers can accomplish when someone else handles the servers. Andrea Passwater shares how convenient it can be to abstract away or remove from view the infrastructure components of development. Ulrich Rabe explains that going serverless can mean giving up control of your deployment and restricts your ability to respond to problems, which is why he helped create Apache OpenWhisk, an open-source serverless environment framework.
And Himanshu Pant considers when to use serverless services.
Visit redhat.com/heroes to check it out today. Subscribe to Command Line Heroes wherever you get your podcasts. Visit redhat.com/heroes for extras and to learn more. That's redhat.com/heroes. And we thank Command Line Heroes from Red Hat for their support of Floss Weekly. And for those of you watching the video, I was down at the Red Hat booth last night, and they did caricatures of people with the words Command Line Hero, whatever I wanted. And I don't know if you can see it in the video, but it's Seattle background, so it's really kind of cool. So for those of you that are just listening to the audio, you're going to miss this out. So please download the video and go in about 10 minutes. You'll probably find it. All right. Well, that's enough of that. So let's go ahead and bring on our guests. So Bhaskar, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm here in Malvern, Pennsylvania. It's a suburb of Philadelphia, which is a small town on the East Coast, a former capital of the United States, partway between New York, another capital, and Washington, the current capital.
Cool, cool. Yes, definitely. Also bring on, where's his name? Scrolled wrong. Chris Edwards. Chris, welcome to the show. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia.
Wow, cool.
Which surprisingly is not far away from the DC area.
Yes, yes, that's cool. Very cool. And so, Bhaskar, let's start with you. So, what problem are you solving when you're reaching for YottaDB?
So basically, YottaDB at its core is a database. And databases live and die by the integrity of the data that's entrusted to them. So, this is a code base which is extremely mature, which is currently used in some of the largest real-time core banking systems in the world, as well as a nation-scale electronic health record deployment. So it's a proven database. It's been around for a long time, continuously enhanced and extended. And what we're doing with it is basically taking that database. All these years, it has essentially been bound to the MUMPS programming language. And that's one of those things which is a little bit like anchovies in your pizza. You either love it or you don't. And what we're doing is we're taking that database and we're extending it to other languages. We've extended it to C, and we're extending it to Go and other languages to follow.
Now, we had Vista on a couple weeks ago. What is there a relationship between Vista and Yotta?
So Vista is basically an application that's written in the MUMPS language, and which counts on the fact that the MUMPS language and the MUMPS database are closely coupled. And Vista happens to run on YaraDB because YaraDB is an implementation of MUMPS, as well as, so it's a MUMPS database and a MUMPS language. And when Vista uses it, it uses the MUMPS language and the database.
And so how did you get involved with this project?
How did I get in? Well, I was 1995, I was looking for a job. And my resume happened to land on the inbox of the founder of a company called Greystone. And he happened to be looking for someone to lead the engineering team. So I had breakfast with him a few days later. And January 1st, 1995, I started working for him. So I've been managing the predecessor of YaraDB since then. And it was run by a small company in Boston. Eventually, I came to lead the company. That company got bought by its biggest customer, and that got bought by a Fortune 500 company and so on. So for 20 years, you've seen the picture of a small fish getting swallowed by a bigger fish, getting swallowed by an even bigger fish. That was the story of my career. Mm-hmm. And then last year, I left the Fortune 500 company, and the code base was open source, and decided that it was time to take that code base to allow exploit its full potential. So, as you know, after all those years, the code base had sort of become like one of my kids. And in fact, when I posted on my Facebook page saying this code base is like one of my kids, one of my sons responded saying, "Well, sometimes I feel like GTM." So there we go. And so we started YaraDB along with a couple of the other long-term members of the team, and we're taking that forward.
Wow, cool. And Chris, how did you get involved?
So mine's nowhere near as interesting as Bhaskar's, but
good thing you went first then.
Yeah,
just kidding.
So basically, I got involved with MUMPS and YaraDB and its predecessors basically through the Vista community. So I have a lot of harks back to the podcast you had a couple weeks ago with that. But basically, I was fresh out of college. I got presented a problem of saying, "Hey, we have this electronic medical record system. We want to do some development stuff for it. We need someone who's a competent sysadmin and can figure out how to make this work." So I kind of got started there, learned the language, picked it up, and kind of progressed through those ranks and started saying, "Well, what other things can I do to make more modern development practices kind of apply to MUMPS, and what other cool things can I do with MUMPS to kind of get it out of maybe its box that it kind of looks at from from developers today that are going through college and kind of new developers from that angle."
Now, we talked a little bit about MUMPS, of course, for the Vista show, but what distinguishes MUMPS? Why is there seems to be a love-hate relationship with it? I suppose it's true about any language, but what's distinct about MUMPS?
I mean, my point of view, what some of the kind of quick turnoffs are is that you can see kind of the age of the language. So most everything can be abbreviated to one letter. So it kind of looks like, yeah. So that's exactly the reaction most people give, is saying, "Hey, everything's one letter. I can't understand the code that I'm looking at. And some of the structures don't follow what are commonly accepted structures today of how people kind of expect code to look. So it's harder for them to kind of read and understand what's going on without them understanding language first and then taking what they understand and applying it to what they're reading. So, I mean, that's kind of some of the stigmatisms I see with that is just the kind of hardness of being it is to understand the language when you're coming at it with knowing something that what I always describe it as is knowing the C-type syntaxes, which is what I see most programming languages follow today, that you have the curly braces, everything spelled out, that kind of thing. MUMPS doesn't use a lot of curly braces, and everything is abbreviated to one letter. And when you know the history of it, you know why everything's abbreviated to one letter. And that's just due to the limited storage space, that kind of thing. When computers were first kind of coming online, we didn't have the horsepower we have today.
I used to dream of having the ability to use ASCII letters instead of hex codes in my programming. Anyway, that's another subject. I'm quite interested in the fact that the project has become open source. Can one of you, maybe Bhaskar, tell me, how long has the YaraDB software existed, Why did you make it open source?
Sure. So the YaddaDB software under the previous brand name of GTM actually has existed since it first went live in 1986. And as a piece of trivia, it first went live at the Elvis Presley Memorial Trauma Center, so you can't get better name recognition than Elvis.
But, that's great.
So in 1998, the company got bought by its biggest customer, and they primarily wanted to use the technology, but they were not interested in really growing the business. So back about 2000 or 2001, we decided to release the software as, well, initially the idea was we'd release it as free software, as in free beer. And rapidly, as we started talking to the community, we became aware of the fact that that really wasn't going to get the software used. It really had to be, you know, free as in open source, not just free beer. And so we decided to release it under an open source license in order to attract more users, because with software, you really need to have people using the software. Otherwise, it's going to stagnate and eventually grow old. And this is software that is being used in mission-critical applications like banking and healthcare. So we released it as open source in about the time frame 2000 or 2001. And it went through GPL v2, then GPL v3, and then eventually AGPL v3. And that was the predecessor GTM. And then when we started YaddaDB, we're basically three members of the GTM team that have been working on GTM for many years. And so we just continued the AGPL v3 license, and that's what it is. But the idea was that we really wanted people to use the software, and we decided that the way to use it was to make it open source.
Right. So you're using the AGPL. Another NoSQL database at the moment, MongoDB, who I'm an advisor to, have decided that the AGPL isn't the right license to use for a NoSQL database in the era of cloud and hosting providers like AWS. Do you feel under the same pressure? Is the AGPL the right license for you?
Well, we think it is, for a variety of reasons. One is that, of course, the upstream code base is AGPL v3, and since we're using a large part of it, we can't really change that unless the upstream developers also change it. But more importantly, I think that, you know, when you talk about software freedom, you really can't turn around and say, well, this software is free mostly. You know, it's either free or it's not free. And the thing is with AGPL, if someone is running it in the cloud, if they're using it for mission-critical applications, typically the cloud provider does not have that expertise. They know how to turn it on. They know how to configure it. They know how to run it. But they really don't have that deep expertise that the development team has. So our view is that eventually people will come to us for support if they're using our software in mission-critical applications, because they will need that depth of knowledge.
So you mentioned an upstream project. What is that upstream project?
An upstream project is it's called GTM, and that is essentially the MUMPS language and the MUMPS database that are closely coupled. And what YaddaDB is doing is basically taking the database and expanding it so that we've made it closely coupled to the C language, for example, in addition to the M language. We haven't given up anything.
Right. So, and you're telling me that MUMPS is under AGPL and is still being actively developed and maintained by someone. Who's that?
There's a Fortune 500 company called FIS and Fidelity Information Services, and GTM is something that they develop, and they use it internally for their banking systems. And again, I used to work for FIS and managed GTM for FIS for 20 years. And so they're continuing to develop it primarily for their own internal use. And we've taken that code base and extended it. And we fixed bugs, of course, in it, but we also have extended it to other applications and use cases.
So do you make upstream contributions? Do you make pull requests to that project, or are you in truth a fork for ongoing evolution of the code?
That's to be determined to some extent. So far, they haven't really taken any of our updates, but it's something that I'm encouraging them to do. And part of that may be because GTM has a funny license where on Linux it's released under AGPLv3, but it's also released under AIX and other proprietary Unixes under proprietary licenses. So, you know, this is, I think, something that they're thinking about, but I hope that they will take our contributions because, again, we have some major contributions that we've made to the code base. But as of now, it's the ball is really in their court.
Right. So towards that end, are you now taking copyright assignment from third-party contributions? And do you have to make copyright assignments to GTM?
Well, we don't make any copyright assignments. And when we take code from third parties, we take it under the same terms of the license. So we've had, for example, members of the community contribute code to us. We've had the software, YottaDB software, ported to the ARM architecture. And those have the copyright of the developer who did it, and he releases his software under AGPLv3 as well.
Right. So going forward, is there very much of a community, or is it just you? I mean, I was looking on your Git repository a little while ago, and there's a fairly limited number of names making commits up there. But is there a community, or is it just you and your colleagues?
There is a community, but it's a fairly small community. And in some cases, at least back in the GTM days, people would make contributions directly by email and say, here, go ahead and merge it with your code. Now, GTM, the upstream project, was open source software, but not run as an open source project with the development being done in the open. Now, in our case, we're doing it in the open on GitLab. We've had some contributions. Now, to some extent, because of the nature of the software and the fact that it's a mission-critical database engine, you really need to have a fair amount of expertise before you can start contributing to it, except in relatively small ways.
Right. So what is your business model with this? Is it your desire to see people freely adopting and deploying YottaDB and then coming to you for support? Or are you looking for licensing in the similar model to other databases like MongoDB?
Oh, we're not interested in going the MongoDB route. We really would like to have... So I take my cue from Linus Torvalds. My goal is, like his, nothing short of world domination. And the way to do that is to have everyone using your software, and I would like everyone using the software and then coming back to us for support. We also do enhancements. So right now, for example, we have a funded enhancement project to make the database available to programmers in Go. And so essentially we have a native Go API, and eventually we do other development like that. So we do funded development, we do support commercial terms with assured service levels, including 24/7 support. We do training.
Right. Now, I'll probably come back to your commercials a little bit later, but I was interested by the fact that you had moved to GitLab. Was there a reason why? Because I think you were on GitHub before, after you started YottaDB. Why did you move to GitLab?
There are a couple of reasons, but one of the big differences from our point of view was the fact that GitLab had projects and sub-projects, so we could organize our software a little bit better on GitLab than we could on GitHub. Now, this is something that we had been considering, and ultimately it was the acquisition of GitLab that sort of said, okay, well, maybe now's the time to actually pull the trigger and do it. But there were technical benefits to GitLab. And one of the other things also was, in the future, it would be easier for us to run GitLab in-house rather than using the external service if we decide we want to do that.
Right. It's an interesting move, and I'm expecting to see more people doing that. So I'm fascinated by YottaDB. It's a very mature NoSQL database it's been a NoSQL database since before anyone knew that NoSQL was anything other than a storage engine. How does YostDB compare with some of the other NoSQL products that are on the market? What differentiates it from those other products?
Well, I think at some point after this, Christopher can jump in as well, because he's been doing some interesting stuff with storing JSON in the YostDB database. But the main thing is it's the proven nature of the database engine. It's the hierarchical storage model. And basically, anything is a key. Anything is a value. It's a little bit like playing poker on a boat and all wet cards are wild. So anything goes as far as the keys and the values are concerned. And we also have the ACID functionality. And then we've actually had database replication for mission-critical applications in production for 20 years now. As far as I know, we preceded even the big brand databases for that. So if you are concerned about the ability to provide five nines availability of the application, not just in the face of unplanned events, but also in the face of planned events, which in some cases are actually harder to deal with than unplanned events, then we have a mature engine for that.
And Chris, do you want to follow up with that?
Yeah. So basically how I look at MOMS and some of the other projects I've worked on, I look at MOMS as basically the universal kind of underlying database system. So kind of looking at the language, looking at what MOMS kind of provides, it provides you a toolkit to be able to create the database that works best for what you need to do. In one of the previous projects before I joined YostDB, I worked on basically a JSON data store database that used YostDB as part of its backend, or could be ran on YostDB as part of its backend, to be able to efficiently store JSON data, be able to retrieve it, be able to query it, and basically add features that were very kind of tied back to how that application needed to work, and provide data very quickly and still have some of the ACID transaction properties. And there's a whole other list of features that go along with that were... It was also insert only, so we could get back the data at any point in time as to what did that look like on a particular day, instead of just saying what's the latest version of that data. So it allowed me to have all the tools at my disposal to get just the database I needed for the application, and have all the reliability behind it that I didn't, that some other databases don't provide quite as easily. I would have to adjust my application to fit into their model of how those needed to be stored.
Now, as I was reading the documentation, I hope it wasn't looking at some other database. Last couple of days have been a blur here at KubeCon, so I've seen a lot of stuff in the last couple of days. So forgive me if this isn't your database that I'm remembering this about. But the wire protocol is Postgres.
That's actually one of our other projects. That we're looking at trying to provide. We have a project of being able to actually provide a SQL database query capability on top of YostDB data. And one of the things that we're looking at is being able to use the Postgres wire protocol to provide all the access into that.
Well, that would be cool. Now, so what am I programming this with? Am I only writing MUMS, or do I start writing things that are sort of normal SQL, or what?
So for that, you would just write normal SQL. The goal for that is to basically look like a real SQL storage engine, just like anything else that you would write SQL for.
Okay. And I also was sort of amused. Again, excuse me if this is somebody else's database, because I've seen so much stuff the last couple of days. But you're actually daemonless, right? How does that work?
So, Bhaskar can probably take this one better than I can.
Sure. So basically, the database engine is packaged as a library that runs within the address space of the application process, and so essentially, in MUMS, it's transparent as to whether it's a wire or whether it's in memory, because it's the language you're programming in. But let's say when you're programming in C, we expose the database engine as a C library, and you make calls to the database, and it actually runs within the address space of the process. And processes cooperate with one another through shared memory to manage the database. Now, the benefits this has are that, firstly, a daemon is potentially a single point of failure. In this case, each process is a single point of failure, so you can have hundreds or thousands, or in some of the larger systems, tens of thousands of concurrent processes accessing the database. And if a process fails, a process fails, but you know everyone else is still up and running. Again, a daemon is potentially a potential vulnerability, because in order to service all the different databases, a daemon typically needs to run with elevated privileges. In our case, a process has access to a particular database file if the operating system user group world model of access gives it access to the database file. And then you can layer on additional security like SE Linux if you want, in order to do context-based access and management as well. So a daemon, so the having the database in memory gives you better security. Having the database running within the address space of the process also gives you much better performance, because there is no latency. The latency is basically the access to shared memory. And so for all these reasons, the daemonless database actually we think is a better model. Now, that said, there are certain cases where people do want Y protocols. There is a Y protocol for the database. And as Christopher mentioned, we are actually, with the SQL engine, we'll be providing other Y protocols as well. But in the highest performing applications that people run on our code base, it's all within the address space of the process. Now, interestingly, at least one of the big brand databases has come up with a product where they take the application and they run the application within the database and charge you a lot of money for it. Well, that's the model that we've always had.
Well, it's interesting, because it's actually the same model as SQLite, where the SQLite is really just a library and it talks to a file. And there's no separate daemon for SQLite. It just runs. So it's very similar to that. So why would I reach for Yotta instead of SQLite if I want similar? Because SQLite already has full SQL.
Well, YottaDB is more than just an SQL database. It's a hierarchical key value database, and there are many classes of problems that aren't easily solved by SQLite. So if SQLite will solve your problem, use SQLite. But there are a large class of problems where it's not sufficient, and it's not just in terms of the data modeling capability. It may also be in terms of things like scalability and business continuity and so on.
Okay. And now another thing that occurs to me then, if it's all in memory, if it's all in shared memory, you're limited by for the size of your database to whatever you can fit in memory, right?
No, not at all. In fact, what we have in shared memory is essentially control structures. In shared memory, we have a cache of database blocks. We have so there are control structures in shared memory, but the database itself resides in storage. So we're really not limited by available memory for storage, and there are routinely applications that are multiple terabytes in size running on, you know, machines that have only gigabytes of memory. Now, in fact, the reason we went with the term YottaDB is because Yotta is actually the largest prefix for scientific notation, according to, there's kilo, omega, et cetera, then there's exa and Yotta. And we actually did a sort of back of the envelope, tongue-in-cheek calculation. We figured that we could actually theoretically scale to a database of a yottabyte. So it was a good name to that reason. So the memory is just there for control structures, and the memory, we don't rely on it to provide persistence. So persistence is provided through the storage engine, whatever that happens to be.
So, in other words, because there's no daemon, each process has the code in it in the library to talk to the common persistent storage, right?
Correct.
Okay. And you deal with that with file locking and stuff to be able to control contention?
Well, we have a large number of different types of mechanisms for managing mutexes and other types of synchronization. So we typically don't lock the file except perhaps when a process starts up the database, and the first process that opens the database has to set up the control structures. But otherwise, we have a large number of in-memory mechanisms for synchronizing, and the processes know how to respect those mechanisms.
Okay. So the other thing that this brings to mind then, though, is does this scale horizontally? Can I have multiple servers in my cluster that are all sharing the same database?
At the moment, you would do that through the wire protocol. Essentially, each database region or each database file would reside on one node in the cluster, and other nodes in the cluster would access that using the wire protocol. We are looking at ways of possibly scaling across the cluster by having the database shared. But what we run into and what we've run into before is we're running applications where we need ACID transactions, which in turn implies serialization. And when you talk about serialization, then that really means making distributed decisions. And distributed decisions are always slower to make than centralizing the decision making. So the way that we've taken the database is to make it as fast and as lightweight and as scalable as possible on a single node. And so far, at least in the benchmarks and the customers that we've come across, we've been able to scale up to their needs on one node with the ability to use the wire protocol across nodes if you need to do accesses, for example.
If you could just push that onto the stack for a moment there, Bhaskar. I was going to come back and ask you a little bit about the business dimensions of what you're doing with YotaDB. So you've started a company that's using this open source code that somebody else owns. That can be a great way of doing business. I've helped start a business that does that myself. How many customers do you have now? What is your global reach for YotaDB at the moment?
We actually do business around the world. In fact, our biggest customers are outside the US. We have customers in the US, but some of our biggest customers are in Asia. And in fact, if you go to our website in Europe, we also have the University of Antwerp, for example. Their library system runs on our database. So we have customers around the world. And again, it's not that that someone else owns the code. We actually own a significant part of the code that we have developed and contributed to the code base. So the way that I would look at it is there's some parts of the code that have someone else's copyright on them, and there's some parts of the code that have our copyright on them, and there are some parts of the code that may have copyrights of community members. But together, it's an integrated, complete code base that we're able to support.
Right. And you don't have any concerns about not owning the copyright to the entire work there?
No, not particularly. From a support point of view, what we care about is that we understand every bit of code that's in the database. And we do that. So I've been working with the code since 1995. Two others who helped start YotaDB have been working with the code base since 1996 and 1997. And so between us, you know, we really know the code base, we understand the code base, and we're able to support it. And ultimately, from a business point of view, what our customers care about is they have someone who's got their back when they need support.
Right. So looking at the code there, one of the things that corporate customers want to know is that the future of the code is secure, as well as the present and the support. Who controls the roadmap of the code? Is it the company that is maintaining GTM? Is it you? Is it a community council? Who is deciding the future of what happens in YotaDB?
Well, YotaDB controls the future of YotaDB, and at this point we have. We're a startup. We started in 2017, but we have a sustainable business in that we're currently operating and we're doing well from a business point of view. We don't have a point at which we're going to run out of cash or anything like that. We're sustainable at this point. Mm-hmm. So we decide the future of YaraDB, and ultimately we will succeed or fail depending on how well we take care of the needs of our customers. And that's something that, at least so far, both on our present and our prior track record, we seem to have done a reasonably good job of. Now, what I don't know is whether we are doing enough to do the world domination part, but certainly in terms of taking care of our customers and growing the business, we have a good track record.
Right. And this NoSQL space, you know, despite the fact that MUMPs pretty much defined the space in the 1980s, it's now become very active with startup companies. And we all know that startup companies mean VCs, and VCs don't buy technology, they buy exits. And we know that exits mean patents. Are you at all concerned as a business owner in this space about software patents coming from other parts of the industry?
Well, it's actually, let me take a step back. I actually have personally a couple of software patents from the days. In fact, some of the very early software patents, actually, I happen to have from previous jobs. And I've come to see software patents as something of an evil, in the sense that they discourage innovation. But at this point, with the maturity of the code base and the technology, I think that if anyone were to come after us for software patents, they might well end up getting their patents invalidated just because of, you know, we can go back, look at the code. It's been out in the open source world since 2000. People can look at it, and it might well invalidate their patents because we may have done it before them. So yes. I don't think that... that I'm concerned about software patents. I don't think that our customers are concerned about software patents, but it's always something that we need to worry about, because one of the dangers is that, we have someone who's a 800-pound gorilla, and they can afford a lot more lawyers than we can, and they can, a big company like that with a large set of attorneys can always make life unpleasant for a small company.
Yes, yes. So are you self-funded, or do you have investors behind you as well?
I have a couple of investors that work with me. So I own part of the company, and we have a couple of other investors, and we're all in it for the long term. And investors are actually interested in using the software rather than necessarily, cashing out by going public.
Right. So do you have an exit in mind here, or do you want to be acquired? You said you don't particularly want to go public. You simply going to carry on doing the evolving self-funded path, or do you have another plan?
Well, let me put it this way. I have no illusions that I'm going to be in this world forever. We all have to deal with the fact that, we all have an exit in front of us at some point. But for the moment, we're all doing well. We're having fun. We're making money. So there's no short-term exit plan. In the long term, obviously, we'll have to figure something out.
Right. That adds a whole new dimension to the idea of an exit strategy, actually. So another question I was going to ask you from a little bit earlier on, we were talking about the AGPL. I noticed in your documentation you have a set of additional terms that clarify the meaning of AGPL. Can you explain why you put that into the bundle? Because there isn't a similar thing in any of your competitors' licensing bundles.
Well, it's mostly a clarification of the way we interpret it. Because when we went with, and again, this was not just in AGPL, but even before that with GPL, where people said, if I write an application and I run my application on your open source software, does that mean that my application also has to be open source? And we discussed it with the attorneys at the Fortune 500 company, and we ultimately said, no, we can draw lines such that the open source software is open source software. If you make changes to that open source software, those changes to that open source software must be released as open source. But an application running on top of that open source software is not affected by the license of that open source software. And there were enough questions coming in from potential users that we felt we might as well, instead of answering the question over and over again, just put it out as a file in our, you know, as part of the software that people could read.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the FAQ approach to dealing with license uncertainty. We've used that in a number of things that I've done. So I heard you a little bit earlier on, you used the expression software freedom. And those of us who talk about software freedom tend to be advocates for open source and free software. Would you identify yourself as a free and open source software advocate?
Very much so. And the way that I got there was when I was running the small company in Boston, the predecessor of YaddaDB, we had this, it was about $1,000 or $2,000, this software that did everything that a small software company could want in terms of managing customers and bug reports and support tickets and so on. And so we used it, and we used it well. And then that company got bought by another company, which got bought by another company and so on. And my little $2,000 piece of software became this enterprise software with a $250,000 entry price that I couldn't afford. And at that point, I began to realize that what open source software or what free and open source software really does is that it shifts the balance of power from the developer to the user. And as a user, if I want to use software, then I want that freedom of knowing that the software cannot be taken away from me. You know, kind of the way that I can go to the bookstore and buy a book and they can't come and take away that book from me. So that's how I became first a user of open source software. And as a user of open source software, I became an advocate of open source software. And today, that's pretty much everything we do at YaddaDB. That's what I use at home. And I actually kicked the Windows habit in 1999.
A little bit after me. I was 1995, sorry, personally. But Randall, I don't know. Are you still using Windows?
No, I haven't used Windows ever in my life. So, yeah. No. That's definitely not. I have a Mac on my laptop here, and unfortunately, we're having Wi-Fi problems. So if I look fuzzy and things like that, that's not me in real life. I just look that way right now. Hopefully, there's at least some video coming your direction.
We are getting a bit of a video, and I can confirm that you are chiseled and not fuzzy in real life.
Yes. Good. All right. Well, like I was interrupting before to say, we're almost out of time. This question will be for both of you, Bhaskar first. Is there anything we didn't cover that you want to make sure our audience is aware of before we have to let you go?
Just the fact that we really didn't get into the technical aspects of how we do ACID transactions, but we use a technique called optimistic concurrency control, which not a lot of other databases picked up on, but which I think has a lot of benefits.
Is this any different from Postgres's MVCC?
I don't know the internals of Postgres's MVCC, but we use a technique that was, the seminal paper was published around 1981 by Kung and Robinson, and H.T. Kung is a professor at the Harvard Department of Computer Science, and it's a technique where for implementing ACID transactions, the process assumes that the transaction is going to commit. And then at commit time, it checks whether there's been any conflict. And if there's been no conflict, then it commits. Otherwise, it retries the transaction.
Chris, is there anything that we should have asked you that you were desperate to say in the program?
Well, I've got two things to bring up. One is that there is a community project called Nodum, which is actually a JavaScript binding for Node.js to YaddaDB. That's maintained by a community member of the YaddaDB community. And there's also another project called QEWD, which is a whole web framework that winds up using the that's also written in JavaScript and uses the GNOME interface to be able to get to YaddaDB to be able to store data and be able to retrieve it efficiently.
It's been great having you on to talk about YottaDB. I think I'll actually download this and play with this a little bit. Of course, I say that about every week because I keep thinking I have way more time than I think I do. So, thanks, guys, for being on the show and talking about YottaDB.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Great, great, great. So that was Bhaskar and Chris talking about YottaDB. What do you think there, Simon? I haven't said that name in a while, sorry.
It is an unusual name as well. It's fascinating. It's like digging around in a rock face and finding a trilobite that's still alive and has been flourishing and has evolved into something more modern. It's a piece of code that has been around for as long as I've been in the computer industry, and it's still there doing cool stuff for big companies. And really giving a run for their money to some of the well-funded upstart startup companies. So I'm loving it. I think it's great, and I would love to dig a little bit deeper. I think next time I need to put some NoSQL in a solution, I'm gonna try YottaDB before I try any of the others. How about you? What do you think, Randall?
No, I like their technical solutions to things, and. I would only be a little concerned about maintaining the code if they ever decide not to, since it's mumps. But hopefully, as long as it just works out of the box, that's pretty much all I need. So we didn't get into some of the technical questions that I want, I didn't ask about OCC. And I also wanted to know how they test this and what kind of a test suite they have, things like that. But we did well anyway. I think we got a good overview of what YottaDB is about. You can always go to their website, which we'll have in the show notes, and we'll talk about it that way. So any other thing before I start talking about who's coming up?
No, I think I share your concern there about its dependence on the MUMPS language. Given how MUMPS has faded in the commercial space and is now very much an in-house tool for a company, I too would have the concern about what the continuity of the code would be like in the event that MUMPS finally bit the dust. But then again, if the MUMPS platform is also under AGPL, maybe that's secure as well.
Yeah, and also we still have COBOL programmers, so I guess if we've got COBOL programmers, we can still do MUMPS as well. We'll just have to keep thawing them out every 15 years when something else needs to be added to it. I wonder if MUMPS had a Y2K problem. That would be interesting. Anyway, I am speculating too much. Let me do the guest coming up before I lose my Wi-Fi connection again. I'm probably cutting out anyway, but you listening to the audio, you'll have none of this, but the people on the video are going to be like, what? His face keeps freezing. Anyway, next week, really excited for this show. Eric Seidel, who's one of the senior guys at Google, is going to be coming on talking about Flutter,
which is Google's mobile app SDK for crafting high-quality native interfaces in iOS and Android in record time. And I am a Google developer expert. I am certified in Dart and Flutter and also web for some reason. I think they just gave that one to me. Guess they figured, I probably know a little bit about the web then. And so he's going to come on, and Flutter hit 1.0, I think it was last week, 2 weeks ago, December 4th. I guess it's last week. And so that's going to be really great. He could talk about what 1.0 really means and how it, what the future of it is, to the degree he can talk about that, because there's somewhat restricted in that. Coming up at the beginning of the year, we've got OpenCast, which is a flexible, scalable, and reliable video capture distribution and management system for academic institutions. I'm really excited about that one. Following that will be Nextcloud. We've had Nextcloud on a few years ago, but they've made some changes since then. They had just barely forked, I guess, 2 years ago. Industry-leading on-premises file sync and online collaboration technology. I think Dropbox, but for free. Okay, that's kind of like what that is. We've got following that is Big Neon. I don't have any notes on it, but it's blockchain something. So I guess maybe I'm just resisting bringing up notes. Excuse me. Zen, who also was on the show before. That's X-E-N Zen. They were on in May 2009. I think a few things have happened to Zen since then, so we're going to have him back on as a sort of a reprise of that. That's a hypervisor using a microkernel design, providing services that allow multiple computer operating systems to execute on the same computer hardware concurrently. Virtualization, basically. Just added to the show, again, I don't have a lot of notes on this yet, but Instacluster has got three big contributions to the open source community around something around Apache, but now I didn't write that down either. But anyway, we'll get more on that next week when I run through the upcoming guests. If you have any other suggestions, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me. If you go to twit.tv/floss, that's the homepage for this show. My email address is there, merlin@stonehenge.com. We do a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus, and that won't go away, by the way. They said Google Plus will only go away for persons like me. So we'll still be Floss Weekly on Google Plus. That will tweet over to @FlossWeekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and @Merlin on Twitter. That's the one that'll go away. And I think they just moved the date in because they just had another data breach. I guess there's nobody at home for Google Plus, so things are still getting messed there. Also, iTunes. I was looking at the reviews the other day for Floss Weekly, and there hasn't been a new one since like 2010. And a lot's happened to the show since 2010. So if you'd please go on there and leave reviews, it helps other people find this show by having more things about open source. So, yeah. I am at KubeCon, which is why my Wi-Fi is so horrible. I guess everybody finally came in. Oh, yeah, I'm looking out the show floor here right now. I'm actually on the next floor above the show floor, and it is packed. Oh, right, yeah, because the keynotes just got over. So now everybody's in here on their devices. That's why my Wi-Fi is going bad. Oh, well, whatever. Do you want to plug anything, Simon?
Coming up at the beginning of February, there is one of the most important and largest free and open source software events in the world called FOSDEM, the Free and Open Source European Developers European Meeting. That's going to be in Brussels, in Belgium, on the weekend of the 2nd and 3rd of February. I'm going to be there, and so are 7,000 of my best friends. And if you have any way at all of being in Brussels at the beginning of February, I really recommend you come along. It's a completely free of charge to attend. All you have to do is find a way to live in Brussels for 3 days and survive the beer and the frites with mayonnaise. A little bit later on, I'm going to be attending a bunch of other events. The most important one that I'd like to draw to your attention is we're bringing the OSI's 20th birthday year to a conclusion with a party at the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley, which at the moment is scheduled for the weekend of the 9th of February. And that's going to be going live really soon at opensource.net. Do please get your tickets and come along to that event. And I'll save plugging anything else for the new year, I think, Randall.
Okay, awesome, awesome. And, you know, every year I say, I got to schedule FOSDEM next year, and I haven't yet. So I'm obviously not prepared to be in Brussels in February, so I guess I'm not going this year again. So I will put a tickler to actually go to the one following. That's probably the only way I'm going to get that to happen. So that's just really bad. Anyway, sorry for the guys watching the video and my face freezing all the time, especially in the last few minutes, but we are on a shared Wi-Fi, and everybody downstairs is sharing it now. So you're probably only hearing about half of what I'm saying, but that's okay. The home audience will hear the whole thing. So we'll see you all again next. Oh, first off, thank you, Simon, for joining me today and covering me when I was offline.
It's my pleasure. There are advantages of having fiber to the home sometimes, even if it is a bit cold and dark over here in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, well, in about 4 weeks, I'll be at ZipRecruiter, and I actually am limited by the speed of the RJ45 cable. It's really, really amazing. So anyway, that's enough for today. That's enough fuzziness for today. We'll see you all again next week, hopefully a little bit clearer, on Floss Weekly.